so give the board.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development on Wednesday, March 11th. Unfortunately, our colleague, Representative Buckley, is still a little bit under the weather, so we're going to carry over House Bill 2670, which is his bill, and hopefully we'll hear that when he is feeling better. With that, we're going to open a concurrent public hearing on House Bill 2516 and House Bill 2513. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2516 requires community colleges and public universities to include cost of required course materials as part of tuition and mandatory fees. We are considering -4 amendments, which were posted on OLIS and will be explained by our witnesses. House Bill 2513 requires Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop, maintain, and manage book buying consortium to purchase academic course materials. It requires HEC to permit participation in consortium by each public university and community college, permits commission to extend participation in consortium to any post-secondary institution of education operating in the state, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Thank you. So we're going to start with Dan Baum, Diana Fisher. Please come forward as you're getting settled. A note for the committee, the nice kind of continuation of our hearing 1 week ago on open educational resources. As you folks know, we heard from Dr. Cable Green. So there's a nice sequence here where we hope you're going to pick up on some of what he said. I know you had a chance to listen to and review his presentation. So we're eager to hear from you.
Certainly, I think I'll go first. For the record, my name is Dan Baum. I am the legislative assistant for State Representative Brian Clem and a student at Chemeketa Community College. Last week, you heard from Cable Green from Creative Commons on what I would call the textbook crisis that is happening right now in our higher education system. He took care of emphasizing some of the dire situations that we are in regarding textbooks. House Bill 2516 is one possible policy solution. I'm sure there are more. Thought at the time for House Bill 2516 as introduced was free textbooks. So just like the K-12 system, you enroll in a class, you show up, they hand you your book. Upon further sort of research, we thought that the likely scenario is that the cost of the book would just get passed along in the tuition increase for the students, and so it wouldn't result in much savings to the student. And so we started kind of thinking about an alternative, which are the -4 amendments. We went online, we researched a little bit, and found these wonderful things that you heard about last week, these online education resources. So we envisioned a program that ideally we would pay Oregon faculty through an RFP process to write these books, and then universities could put them, or anyone could put them online for free to distribute to the students for free if the professors chose to assign that book to their course. We found that program through Open Oregon State, and so we changed the bill to just throw them a little bit of money, throw them a lot of money actually, to help get these OERs out to the students as quickly as possible. So with that, I'm here for questions, and I will pass it on to Open Oregon State to tell you about their program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
Sorry, Mr. Ball, maybe pull the mic a little bit closer to you. So you're saying the bill originally, you've changed it now, and now the process is to have university professors write them and put them on for everyone's use? I didn't.
The process, or the bill originally was just free textbooks. It was a mandate for colleges. It was free textbooks. We have are since gotten stuffing that with the -4 amendment, which would provide funding for Open Oregon State to develop and distribute
and
these.
That is in OLIS?
The -4 amendments are in OLIS. I'm looking
at
them.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Speaker.
Sure.
No problem. So let's hear from you, Ms. Fisher, and then I expect we will probably have questions.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Diana Fisher. I'm the director of Open Oregon State at Oregon State University. And I have just a few short slides to talk about what my unit is doing. For the previous 15 years, I was the director of the online education group who built the online courses. And last year, due to some of the costs that students were facing, we decided that we would institute this new unit and try to help with textbook costs for students. So how do I change the
arrow keys?
It's not changing.
The right one, maybe.
It changes here, but it's not changing there. Ah.
There you go.
No. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. So just to give an idea of where my unit is in the university, we are part of Extended Campus, which in turn is part of the Division of Outreach and Engagement. On my website here, it's very easy to see that we are instituting several different programs in addition to textbooks, but today I was just talking about textbooks. We have some open learning modules. We have some completely open courses for students to take. So one of the things that brought us to trying to address this textbook issue is for last fall term, we looked at the 6 highest enrolled courses on campus, and if every student had purchased the textbook just for those 6 courses that they were enrolled in, it would have cost them over $1 million. Mm. Now that's one term at the university and only 6 courses with just the students enrolled in those 6 courses. So each term at the university, there are at least 800 courses that students can choose from. So more than half of the students, 63%, reported not having purchased the required textbook because of the high cost of those textbooks. And given a choice between courses to satisfy a requirement, students are not taking the class that interests them. They're choosing the one with the least expensive textbook. And that's not really what we think is a way for the students to get their education. They're not choosing something that really interests them. So in a partnership with the OSU Press and with the libraries, we found a couple of university professors who were willing to start out to create open textbooks for their students. This one right here you can see is published by the Oregon State University Press. It's called Living with Earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest. It retails for $29.95 if they would like to purchase a print copy. But we have made an edition of this completely open and free to the students. And you see it says this edition is also available as an open access textbook. This was the very first textbook that we did for students at OSU. There are 400 students a term who take this at OSU, which is saving them $12,000 a year, which probably doesn't sound like a lot of money, but to the students it is. And this is just at OSU. With this textbook, it is also used in California and Washington. So both the California schools and the Washington schools can take advantage of this being open also. This is another one that is a really great textbook we are doing right now. The textbook that this book replaced was $259. It has about 150 students a term, which saves them $38,000 per term. Each year, that's about $155,000 that students are not having to spend on a textbook just for this course. Again, this textbook is open and free for anyone in the world to use, not just Oregon State University students. Over 100,000 downloads as of October. We have not yet updated that. So in California, one of the reasons why we started doing this, in California there were 2 bills that were passed that said that their top 50 lower division courses would have openly licensed digital textbooks available at no cost and print versions available for less than $20. Also in Washington, their top 81 highest enrolled courses would have the same. We are trying to model what we're doing on this so that we would have the lower division courses with the high cost textbooks available to the students also. So several different current projects that we're working on, the partnership with the OSU Press and the libraries that I mentioned, and we have a project to fund faculty to adopt already written open textbooks and write a review. And this is important to us because we look at this the same as how the textbook companies keep publishing different editions that students have to buy. So if there's already an open textbook out there that someone has written that's really great, we urge our faculty to adopt that at no cost to the students. And then that saves us some funding that we can give to faculty to write a textbook that is not already open. And some of the pushback that we've gotten for faculty in the past is that they don't know how good the textbook is. We provide a small amount of funding for them to peer review the textbook so that their colleagues will be able to look at that and choose that textbook too. We have a project with Summer Session right now going on to fund faculty to use open course materials, and that went live last week, and I've already had over 25 inquiries for that for Summer Session. We hope to be able to provide a majority of Summer Session courses with no textbooks, cost for students, and we are currently working with LBCC, Lynn Benton Community College, to fund faculty to create additional text for lower division courses that our universities share together. And so why did OSU decide to do this? Our first impetus for this, in addition to wanting to address textbook costs for the students, is that Oregon State is a land-grant university, and our mission is to provide access not just to the students but to everybody. But our faculty has a culture of research and collaboration and sharing, and so we have the experience with that too, with our online programs. We know how to get this done and get it out there. So we thought, well, let's take an initiative and let's get this started and help the students out.
Very good. Thank you. Now that we've been joined by Representative Clem, let's give him a chance to speak, and then I imagine we'll have questions for all three of you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development, I'm here on the two bills you've got open. I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21, and I'm not going to add much. I listened to the first part. I'm sorry I'm late. I came from my second job where I am trying to earn money for my daughter's college textbooks starting 11 years from now. So if I start now working graveyard, I think I might finally have enough by the time she's in college. So I just want you to know how hard Dan's worked on this and how responsible he's been about not trying to force something down other people's throats, whether they liked it or not, such as free textbooks at the expense of the university, regardless of the pain inflicted upon poor Jock in the back or any other Debbie Koreskes who've come to my office to meet with Dan. He's been doing a lot of homework on, because I think we all want to do something about the cost of textbooks. The question is, what is the something? And this model that that has been up and running now at OSU is working very well as a way to provide significant savings to students and significant savings in the system overall. But it needs more funding if you're going to expand beyond those numbers of textbooks. And so I think this is a really pretty wise approach. It wasn't that the other ones wouldn't work, but they faced significant difficulties in trying to come up with a way to implement them, whereas we have a program that's largely operational already and just needs more resources. I know that I have heard quite a bit about the $300 million that could be saved annually by students with a very modest investment by the state of Oregon. And if you'd like, I bet he'd run you through all the exact criteria and how that works. But I've heard it several times, and I want to say how proud I am for working on an issue so diligently, because usually he will tell me he's not the policy guy. But this one, he's gone all the way to the mat to learn these policy in and out. I can see from his bullets compared to what he said in the testimony. He has not filled you in with everything he knows about this, but he's become quite the expert in college textbooks. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clem. Are there questions for these gentlemen? Representative Gygos and then Representative Nierman.
Well, I'm trying to think about this from an administrative standpoint. The universities are businesses, and they work on incentives and rewards. And I'm particularly interested in how anybody can publish a book. Anybody can write a book. And so what I would tell my students is that's the purpose of journals and why we would require them to really use at least 5 journal references in any of their term papers, right? Because that's peer-reviewed by the public, not just by selected. The other thing is that from an administrative standpoint, from the universities, promotion and tenure books are valued in promotion and tenure, but not so much as, again, the published journal articles. How is this going to play out in terms of promotion and tenure, faculty time? You said you're doing RFPs, giving small grants to write these textbooks. And then you did say that there was a peer review process involved as well. like I said, I'm just curious how it's going to stack up against that sort of traditional university process.
Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos. One of our advantages, I think, that addresses the question is that we do have the partnership with the Oregon State University Press, which is a book publisher. So any of the books that the faculty are writing through our program are actually published by the Oregon State University Press, and they have a press imprint. So their publications through this program are the same as if they were publishing any other book. They have the editorial board and the peer review process, and they become an actual textbook, but also they are a book listed in the press's catalog, so it looks as if it is any other book. The difference is that there is a link available for a free download for that book in addition to the opportunity to buy a print copy. So with those that go through this process, it has the whole peer review process, and so they do count as a publication for promotion and tenure for faculty, which has been particularly attractive to junior faculty.
Thank you. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this has a $5 million, I guess this question is for Ms. Fisher. This has a $5 million allocation to Oregon State University. So a couple of different questions. First of all, how does that money get spent? Does that get doled out to faculty on a grant basis or whatever to create those textbooks? And second question is, what happens to the other universities? So what about Portland State? What do they do?
Representative Chair Reed and Representative Nierman. one of the plans that we have, we've spent the last year getting our foundation set, and our plan is to work collaboratively with the other universities. So with our program we have right now, we're currently working with LBCC on some of the lower division courses, but we would love to be able to work with all the other universities and get faculty together and model our program a little bit on what the University of British Columbia has done, where they get faculty together who teach the same courses and get them into a room where they hammer out what they would like the textbook to look like. And so we've got faculty from, you know, we could get from all seven universities who teach this one lower division course, and they all come together and they figure out how they want the textbook to look and what they would like in each chapter, and then they go off and each write their chapters and come back and put it together. So then we've got a faculty member from each of those universities who not only is going to use the book, but who also had a hand in writing the book. And to address the funding issue, what we have been doing so far is offering a $20,000 grant, or up to $20,000, for faculty to write these books. So with a larger amount of money, we would be able to get more faculty in here, and then faculty from other universities also to work on these together and collaborate. So I think that the majority of the faculty we've worked with so far have been using the funds that we've been giving them as a course buyout so that they can sit and actually concentrate on writing these in a timely manner. What we've been contributing for I guess you would call it an in-kind contribution, is on my team we have multimedia programmers, we have regular programmers, we have graphic artists, we have all of those things. So all of these textbooks that we are creating are not just print on the page, but they're online and they're fully interactive. So with the earthquake book as an example, we've got the world earthquake expert who actually wrote that book, and he worked with us to create multimedia. So rather than explaining in text how tectonic plates move, we've made a multimedia interaction. So students can read that, and then they interact with it, and then they can go back and read. So what we're doing is we're creating an experience, and what we would really love to do is collaborate with the other universities and community colleges as a group.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Fisher, so you don't have any plans or any specific plans to collaborate with the other ones? You just hope to do that?
Yes, we do, Representative Nimmer. We do have two collaborations going on right now with LBCC, with the Lynn Benton Community College, because they are our closest. We are able to work with them quite easily. We have a meeting coming up in May where all the universities will be there to meet with us, and that's where we're going to talk about who would like to participate in this. I believe it's mid-May.
Thank you.
This exchange spurs me perhaps to say, at least for myself, the combination of these bills and the concepts we're talking about today and last week's discussion makes me think there's something in this. I'm not sure that this bill by itself or the concepts that were last time are yet in their final form, but I hope the rest of you will join me in exploring this and figuring out what are the elements that we want to have in a bill. So I had Representative McEwen, and then we'll come back to Representative Johnson.
And Chair Reed, thank you. I actually think you've answered my question with your last response. I was trying to tease out how community colleges fit into this. I was, a good portion of the time, our most financially constrained students mm-hmm. are attending community college, and I'm very interested in how you intend to partner with them and what the time frame is in bringing them on board and what the challenges will be when we have 60 campuses of community colleges under 17 umbrellas, and how that's all going to fit in, because I think it in the original bill it was mentioned, and it's still in the relating clause, I believe. No, it's still in the headline, but hopefully we will keep that on the forefront, I guess. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Well, again, as the longest-serving member of House Higher Ed.
You're the senior member.
Senior member up here, yeah. You know, we have studied this issue to death. You know, it goes back to 2011. I think Representative Dembro had a hearing. We packed the room with college kids saying, you know, we've got to do something. So we passed a bill saying we got to study something, which we did. I think from there it migrated over to, I think there was a HEC work group that was commissioned to investigate it, and they said, yeah, textbooks are too expensive. So, okay, duh, we know that. And now we're back again, and we're at that time, and I'm just piggybacking on your comments, Mr. Chair, that it's time for some action. I'm not saying we're going to fix it necessarily in one session, but we need to not leave this session without doing something that will move the agenda forward. And if it's focused at community college level, perhaps, maybe we can get something underway there. But there's no reason why in the age of the Khan Academy that we have continue to rely upon traditional textbooks for every student in every course. It just makes no sense to me. But I guess there's a couple things about the proposal here that give me pause. And again, the words academic book buying consortium sounds like an incredible bureaucratic mess to me. I don't know what that means. We've had so many consortiums of education and higher ed. I see parochialism all over this again, protecting my turf and stuff. So I think maybe it's just the framework. But I think we need to look past the traditional books and into open sourcing, at least on some basic core courses that should be able to happen across the board for some of those, for our students, and start there, and then we can build into something else. But I would just throw out as an op, if we wanted to have a committee work group on this, I'd be happy to be a part of that.
Thank you. I appreciate
work with you on that, Mr. Chair, and anybody else. But I really appreciate what you've done and brought it before us again, because I did have a chance to talk to the little pep rally, the student rally, when they were here last month, you know, and you start talking about the price of textbooks, and it gets everybody's attention. Everybody says, yeah, please do something right now. So I really do think the time is right. So,
thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rudin, then Representative
Well, just heated agreement with everything Rep. Johnson said. We've got to get this moving. I can't think of much better return on investment than this. My only concerns, just as we tweak these bills, are want to make sure that we maintain on the printed versions a good production quality. So I grew up on mimeograph stuff.
Is that your standard, Representative Rudin?
It's pretty much, yeah. Handwritten, too. Realizing you could print everything in black and white, it needs to be color, because that helps with the retention of the information and the comprehension of the information. So just those sorts of things that in the interest of keeping costs down, we want to make sure that the materials are still effective. So,
thank you. Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, in a poker term, I'm all in on this concept, but I have a reservation here, or maybe a comment for an additional amendment as we go through the process. I understand the concept of not wanting to try and have the faculty work with something that they haven't had input into it. But if there's a peer review system to review these at the faculty level that's already gone, which we heard last week, an extensive, what it sounded like, an extensive peer review system anyway. I'm not familiar with exactly how that works, but we're learning about that. If that initial peer review system went through and then the faculty had a peer review system to look at it quickly and decided there was a subject that wasn't fitting to the didactic curriculum that you wanted, would we not first want to apply to the main open source for that $1 million grant to try and go into the original system rather than have the state backfill that? And so I'd like to see some conversation about, okay, if we need something a little bit different, let's join the open source here where they're giving $1 million to write that and have our faculty concentrate on that first to see if they could get awarded a, you know, a bid on that process rather than going directly to the state. So just a comment.
Thank you. Representative Wisden.
I'm on board, too. I don't have any poker chips, but I'm all in, too. But what could you tell us what's been the reaction from the professors and the deans, and what kind of reaction has Oregon State had from your effort, which we applaud?
And maybe I could add to that question. The one I was going to ask was, on one of your slides, you said you had a bullet that said something about funding faculty to adopt an already written open textbook. So maybe that's another way of asking your question. Can you talk some more about that, please?
Sure. Chair Reed and Representative Wisden, I'm happy to do that. So first, to address the already open, that's another means we have of making sure we make the best use of the funds that we do have. So we don't want to fund faculty to write something that's already perfectly acceptable out there. And so one of the things that my unit does when a faculty member comes to us and says, I would like to adopt an open textbook, we spend some time looking for what's already out there first, giving them that list. And one of the great things with the Open Textbook Project is you can take a textbook out there that's open, that's already been written, and if you only want to use four chapters of that, you just pull those four chapters out. And then if you have some other notes that you need, you teach that class just a little bit different, or you add something, you can add your chapters to that, and that becomes your textbook. So with the open textbooks, it's adopt other people's, and that's the great thing about it. And so to address the reaction that we've had from the faculty, so far it's been really great. Our very first RFP we put out asking faculty, telling them that we had this opportunity, we had 14 in just a couple days from faculty who were all excited about this. And some of the reasons that we got were really interesting. They went from I don't want textbook companies telling me how to teach my course and in which order or what to put in it, all the way to I've got such a specialized class that if I were to assign textbooks, I'd have to assign four or five textbooks in order for me to pull in all the materials. So we've had those. We've also had senior faculty who say that with the textbooks they've already written, they're upset at the price that the companies, textbook companies, have put on the textbooks that they've written, and they think that they should be doing something to help students too. So the reaction from the faculty has been wide-ranging. We haven't had any negative reactions from them.
How much of your interaction is sort of self-selecting? Are they the folks who are the faculty members who are already interested that are coming to you? Are you going out and finding a little more reluctant or skeptical faculty members? What can you say about that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's a great question, Chair Reed. We've done both.
Okay.
We have, for the first two RFPs we put out, we wanted to get the willing and the early adopters, the eager faculty to do that. And so that's what we did for the first two. And those are in production now. And what we are doing now, and one of the reasons why we're working with LBCC on this, is because we want to target those lower division, high enrollment courses with the really expensive textbooks. It seems that the lower division courses have the more expensive textbooks than the upper division courses. So working with them, and with Oregon State having the degree partnership program with all of the community colleges, colleges. We're hoping that we can get even more of them in, and then we can make a larger impact.
So the reluctant or skeptical faculty, are they? How's the interaction been with them?
It's been okay so far. The hurdle I think that they've had to get through was, first of all, time.
Yeah.
Many of them are quite busy in teaching a lot of courses, and so they have to find the time to go through something new and redo their course because their courses are set with the different chapters for the textbook that they've been using for a couple years. So they need to find the time to redo their course, redo the structure of their course. So that's where we give them a small funding grant to help with that, and then our team will also help them with that.
Thank you. Representative Rudin and Representative Wisniewski. Yeah.
Under the current system using traditional textbooks, are professors compensated by the publishing companies in any way?
I have no idea.
I'm happy to be corrected. I think it's a matter of a negotiation. There may be royalties, there may be an upfront payment, but others can probably add to that as we conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Fisher, you say that we're all enthused about this and want to help. Are we going to get in the way? What would you ask us? What would you ask us to do? I mean, you seem like
to do.
Sounds like you've got a point of moving on. Sometimes competition with the other universities following your lead may be better. What would you comment or suggest to us?
That's a great question. So, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Wisniewski. I don't look at it as a competition. I would really love the collaboration, because if we're all working together, then that's really going to benefit the students. So I'm not looking at it as a competition of any sorts.
In collaboration with the legislature too.
that would be great too, because if you're behind it and you're saying good things about it, then it gives it a little bit more of an impact, I think.
But we follow up, Mr.
Yes, please.
But we do have a tendency sometimes to try to over direct or over guide, and so if the chair decides to form a group, we'd appreciate your input and be sure we're not getting in the way, we're not over regulating, over directing.
Thank you.
Representative McHugh.
Thank you, Chair Reed. From a very high level, we don't need to get way in the weeds on this, but are there technical challenges for other campuses in delving into this arena as far as actually the campus technical infrastructure or the ability of the student to have the devices that they need to access this?
The textbooks that we've done so far, we've made them in several different formats. We have a plain HTML format that is directly on a website that's available to anyone at all, including it is ADA accessible to students who are using a screen reader. And then we've got an iBook version that's fully interactive that can be used on an iPad or anyone with a Mac computer. We've also got a PDF version that is fully interactive that can be looked at on any e-reader or downloaded again to a computer, and we have a version that works with the Amazon Kindle. And once we get that one version of it, all these others are saved quite easily. So we've been trying to put what we do into at least 5 different formats to make it as accessible as possible to anyone who can use it.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Yes, thank you so much for this. And I hope you appreciate that this is kind of like a peer review process right here. We're really actually looking for holes to poke in your proposal that we can think about how we can address them. And I'm still curious about what the difference is in terms of the traditional process of a professor writing a book, getting royalties. As you say, usually there's sometimes some upfront money, and then not a heck of a lot in terms of royalties, but how does that compare, again, in terms of the incentive for professors to do this? You give them a small grant up front, and is that sort of comparable to what they can anticipate in terms of royalties or whatever?
Thanks. That's an excellent question, and And one of the things that we've looked at is, first, we don't give them the grant up front because that doesn't really give them incentive to work. so we set benchmarks. And you're right, there is a royalty that they'll be foregoing with a print textbook, but that really isn't that much money. And with us working through the press, they still do get a royalty for anyone who orders a print copy, because the print copy needs to be paid for. We are trying to price those just at cost. We don't want to, but we do need to pay for paper. So all of the online versions are completely free, but a print copy can be open to the public too. And that earthquake book that I used as an example is ordered by members of the general public too, not just by students. And we have several others that are the same. They're interesting to public in addition to students, and so there will be royalties on those. They're not giving up all their royalties, but they are getting some funds to hopefully make up for those.
Yes, please.
Just for the rest of the committee, too, just to point out that faculty, when they write a book, the royalties on these books is very small. You get like pennies on a book. The publishers actually are the ones that really reap the benefit. Do you have your RFP? I'd like to look at one, and maybe this summer I can drive it.
Summer project?
Yeah, there you
Professor
go.
Gallegos?
Yes, right.
All right, that's good. Representative Johnson, then Representative Newman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would rephrase Representative Wisnett's question slightly differently and ask, is there statutorial support that we could offer you that might help your efforts, i.e. either in expanding the scope and scale or expediting the time frame? And if you don't have those answers today, that's okay. But I guess I would just say, as we consider legislatively doing something, what would it be that might help expand these efforts and make it beneficial to more students as quick as possible?
Good question.
Sure, I'll take a shot at that one. I think that Dr. Green last week mentioned one of the things towards the end of his testimony that we can do to help move forward with OERs is to find and look at any existing statutes that are getting in the way of funding and getting them out there. I don't know what those would be, but that is definitely something worth looking into.
Well, please keep us in the loop.
Yes, please.
And we do
yes,
have please. The examples of Washington, California.
Yeah, of course. Victoria.
Ms. Fisher, you gave some specific examples early on about the cost savings that you were able to achieve with your program so far. Have you extrapolated that to determine what kind of cost savings you could accomplish with $5 million?
The numbers are kind
you
of
may not
overwhelming
have picked the $5 million, by the way.
But. The numbers are kind of overwhelming there.
Let me ask an intermediate question, which was one that was on my mind too. What's your current funding level and its source, and then maybe get to the $5 million.
My current funding comes from outreach and engagement. Because I am part of OSU Extended Campus, we have an online course fee that I am able to access a small amount of that because it's benefiting online students in addition to on-campus students. So I was given a small amount of money, only $500,000 to start out for the year, or actually for 2 years. And so we've had to be very careful with what we're doing and look at what would make the biggest impact. And that was really interesting over the last year to try to get the willing faculty to buy into this and then also try to make the biggest impact. So we're very fortunate that a couple of the high enrollment classes, such as the biology and biochemistry, have agreed to work with us.
Okay. So back to Victoria's question. With $5 million, what would you do? What kind of impact would you have?
I think one of the things I would really love to do is try to make the biggest impact on the high enrollment, lower division courses. If you look at a textbook such as being used for Math 111, every student has to take Math 111, and that textbook is over $200. And you know, if you're going to teach a quadratic equation or, you know, any other college algebra, you don't need a specialized textbook to do that. However you teach that equation is really, it doesn't change. So if we could get the faculty together to agree on either what to bring into the textbook and do that exactly the way that they want to and buy into teaching out of that textbook, I think that's an example of what we could do. So any of the lower division courses, things like Civil War history, which every student, again, takes for the baccalaureate core, those textbooks don't change. So if we got faculty together to create those, it would make a huge impact.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I might just share with you, Mr. Chair, the California and Washington sort of figures. Washington put in $750,000 initially, which was matched by another $750,000. And the author of the bill, at least, it claims that it saves $41 million annually for that investment. I'd probably want to go check with their fiscal office to see. California,
nice,
I can tell you, really did put in $5 million for their from their scholar share trust fund, and they asked to be matched with another $5 million. That produced 50 books. So their law said that, you know, essentially these universities must, assuming we give you money, mm-hmm. must take the top 50 most common and do it. And they gave it about $5 million matched with another $5 million, so $10 million bucks to get those 50 done.
I think I'm remembering Dr. Green talking about some other bill that passed subsequent to that, which locked up some portion of that money. So the result you mentioned is right, but it didn't take all the money to get that result. Does anybody else remember that? Did he say something like that?
Okay.
I think it might
be Washington or California.
No, California. So I think it might even be better than what you described in terms of the money that they had to spend to get there.
And it sounds like they spend about $450,000 annually to operate the exchange.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I see the operating expense to me seems like that should we should have more for that, so you can have these professors come in and make them get on board, encourage them to get on board and look at this. So that to me, operating cost is going to be a big factor to give you more operating cost to make this happen.
And even have perhaps kind of primitive way of describing it, but the librarian who can help them figure out which one's available and which one fits for them.
But I don't usually encourage more FTE, but I can see where the advantage you would be.
Great.
Representative Woodson, one of the great things that I'm able to do, since Oregon State University has a new media program and a computer science program, and I'm able to employ students from those programs. So I have quite a few student workers who are multimedia programmers, who are digital artists, who can set the page how it is. So in addition to, you know, making an impact on their textbook costs, I'm also employing the students.
Their skills, even better. That's great.
Developing a workforce, too.
That's right. Representative Nierman, we haven't forgotten about you. Mr. Baum, you got a comment, too, please?
Thank you. I wanted to, I don't think that this committee needs any more reason to support this. You seem very enthusiastic, as you did last week when Dr. Green was here. So thank you for that. But I wanted to provide you with a few numbers in case you needed it. There's about 235,000 community college and public university students in the state. They spend about $1,300 annually on textbooks on average, which is a $300 million cost to the students just for the state of Oregon, much of which is going to be debt when they graduate. And so I can't imagine any scenario where it would take, it's just speculation, but more than a fully funded, fully realized OER system that would save $300 million, you may cost $100 million, $150 million. But there's no way that you're not going to get a major return on investment here.
Thank you. Representative Nierman, and then come back to Representative
Thanks. Were you following this line of questioning? Do you want to just go ahead? Okay. So just kind of a simple question. What kind of this is for Mrs. Fisher. What kind of licensing arrangement do you have? When Dr. Green was here, he talked about different types of licenses and all that.
Representative Nierman, thanks. That's an important question. We require a Creative Commons license on those. The only requirement that we have for them, they are allowed to choose their own license. The only requirement that we put on it is that it be the non-commercial. So when the open textbook or open materials are out there, the NC
requirement means that a textbook publisher can't come along, take those open materials, and then resell them at a profit. So there are instances where a faculty member might want to put the no derivations on there if it's a process that if someone changed their writing, then it might make the process invalid. So we are fully aware of that, but we do require no commercial so that nobody can take it and make money from it.
Okay. Representative Gallegos.
I think this is my final question, but it has to do with you were talking about your research indicates that a lot of students don't buy the books for classes, or my experience is they share books quite often. It has nothing to do with their actually reading the assignments, but that's what they tend to do. My question really has to do with data collection with regard to students. Do you have any data, or how are you gathering the data with regard to student use of these open books?
Right at the moment, the only thing that we are doing to track number of downloads, so we can tell the number of downloads and the number of times that each page is used. Oregon State is in the process of switching its learning management systems to something called, it's a consortium that we are in called Unison. When we get that repository up, we'll be able to do a lot more, but we're in the middle of the transition, and so we're not able to address that as fully as we will in the process. In spring, we'll be able to start testing it, and we'll be able to have some really great numbers. And what we also hope is to be able to build in some additional data analytics into what we're doing that will enable us to track better.
Very good. Thank you. I think we've put you through a few questions, so we're grateful for your answers, and hopefully our enthusiasm and interest is coming through. Thank you very much. Dana Richardson's here from the HEC, and a little bit out of order. Bob, I wonder if you could join us as well. We have a question that's coming through the interwebs that I think you might be uniquely qualified to answer about the impact of this concept. So let's hear from you, Dana, and then I'll pass along the question, Bob.
Good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos from WISMET. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Policy and Legislative Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I can almost say that one breath, but not quite. I'd like to speak to House Bill 2513 and House Bill 2516 separately. I've submitted testimony on House Bill 2513 that would direct the HEC to establish a book buying consortium. Now, I don't like to think of us as a bureaucratic mess. I did write down, right, but it would be a big
lift
for us. It would be a big lift for us, and that's what the testimony indicates, the type of capacity that we would need to build, in large part to coordinate with campuses so that you're not duplicating efforts that they have with regard to book buying and with what the HEC would be doing. So I've submitted information on that. On 2516, it's been really exciting to work with Representative Clem's office on this. Dan really has been very open to ideas. And as Representative Johnson mentioned, yes, this is something that the HEC was charged to work on and has been working on. Their efforts over the past couple year and a half have included a literature review, a review of the current activities on campuses with regard to textbook affordability. They've done an affordability survey. They got a terrific response, a lot of participation from students and faculty on campuses informing us about what they do. And then they held regional forums as well. So some of the existing things that are going on campuses include library textbook checkout programs, student textbook exchange consortiums, and, of course, the development of OERs, as you've all heard so much about. They looked at all these practices and kind of did a strengths and weaknesses analysis, and I think some of the strengths of the OERs are obvious, the low cost or no cost in a lot of cases. Some of the challenges associated with them are the availability of high-speed internet, as Representative McCune mentioned, and then, of course, the investment of faculty time to kind of vet the resources and develop the comfort in order to be ready to use them in their courses. So with Representative Clem's permission, I've got kind of a couple alternatives to present as a way to approach it, and honestly, it's really
you all came up with it, and now I'm just going to say it back to you, because you've mentioned really all of these components. And what the HEC could do, there are a couple ways you could do it. The HEC could focus less on using state dollars for content development as opposed to spending dollars to convene peer review teams from community colleges and universities. Because I think that's what you need in order to get the coursework used, is to get the buy-in and the comfort with it meeting their standards. So that you could provide some state dollars for the HEC to convene peer review teams, and you could focus initially on the courses that are in the Oregon Transfer Module, which are the highly used courses. You could also focus, you could go through and figure out what are the most expensive texts, and you could focus on developing, you know, a peer review of those as well. That's another alternative. And then just as another option within that, you could, it wouldn't have to be something that the HEC kind of organized and led, but you could drive that money out to campuses to take the lead in developing the peer review teams to existing resources. So with Representative Clem's permission, I offer that as an alternative.
Thank you. Let's actually, yeah, go ahead, Representative Wisnant, then I have a fairly specific question for
Mrs. Richardson, Deputy Director Richardson. We have an organization that's already seems to be leading the way here. Could also an alternative be to let them be the lead for this and supplement them with other, you know, from other staff? Could you include that as an option too, or think about that?
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnant, I certainly think that's the case. I just think you want to make sure everyone feels, and particularly the community colleges, as you've mentioned, that they're part of the process.
So, Ms. Brew, Representative Williamson is obviously not here, but she's following our hearing from the internet.
Surgery so it
sounds like her surgery went well, and she's watching and has a question. So this is on her behalf, but I think it's a very good question, and it's to ask how the cost of textbooks are included or not included, or how they're handled in the calculation of financial aid packages and assessment of need and that sort of thing. I think we're right in asking you that question.
Chair Reed, thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I'm Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. And thank you for the question. So the way that textbooks are included, each year we get a report from each of the universities and community colleges on their average cost of tuition and fees, textbooks, transportation, housing, and so on. And we use this as a calculation of cost of attendance for each of those colleges or universities. And this is also reported to the federal government, and we report it on our website. And so these are calculations that are determined by the university and reported to us. And that total of that, of those calculations, becomes the maximum amount a student could receive in a total financial aid package. So that's how we use that in our calculation and how universities and colleges use it.
So what degree of specificity is in that? Is it an average across different majors and courses? Is it how specific does that calculation get?
Chair Reed, yes, it is an average.
Okay.
And it's also a year old.
Okay. And so would the concepts, recognizing that we're talking in wide generalities so far, but what impact would the concepts we're talking about here have on that if we're driving down the cost of textbooks, which is a good thing, I think everyone would agree, do we need to make another change in the process you use to calculate need to avoid reducing awards based on reduced cost of textbooks?
So thank you, Chair Reed. That calculation of the maximum financial aid award is a federal process. So we would have very limited ability to change that. However, and if we were able to reduce the average cost of textbooks, that would reduce the average award. Financial aid award. I'm sorry, not the average financial aid award, but the maximum financial aid award. In turn, since loans are often the financing source of last resort, we would suppose that as that cost goes down, students would take out fewer loans. Did that make sense?
Yes. Okay.
Sure. As I'm looking at this, I actually kind of think that there may be some more wisdom in the original 2516 draft, but the timing might be off a little bit. And my thought is that this type of legislation that you originally drafted might be better suited for 2017 after the HEC or whatever avenue we do to implement the open sourcing. Once the open source is available, generally, then wouldn't we want the original draft of 2516 to come back to kind of push that along the way so that universities were more inclined to adopt it?
Representative Reed, may I respond?
Please.
Chair Reed and Representative Hayden, I think there's merit to that suggestion. Absolutely.
Thanks. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean, I'm wondering, you mentioned the peer review process. Could that happen at the community college level, separate from the university level? Obviously, they have different needs, serve different student population, or would you envision one larger consortium? I'm just personal feelings, you know. What do you think?
Chair Reed and Representative Johnson, we using the Oregon Transfer Module mm-hmm. courses, which are offered at community colleges and universities, and my thinking was that the faculty would do it jointly in between two-year and four-year institutions. But if it made more sense, you could look at things that are specifically, you know, maybe mm-hmm. offered in a different way at the community colleges mm-hmm. and the universities.
And just a follow-up then, I guess I would just again... Would it mandate that the HEC need to be involved, or could we just simply turn this over to OCCA and say, here, you guys figure something out that's good for you, and then hopefully something on at the university level, too? I'm not trying to have a dog in the fight either way. I'm just saying, would it necessarily follow that the HEC has to steer the process or shepherd the process?
Representative Johnson, no, that wouldn't be the case. I mean, I think ultimately the state investment is what makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think you're subtle with your pencil there.
I know. I'm going to get a little light on that.
What's that mean?
Yeah, there you go. It's related to the question that Representative Johnson just raised. I mean, it just seems to me that we're talking a lot about how do we really standardize those courses and those offerings around the core courses. So I would see the community colleges and the four-year institutions, really, if we can align those core courses with similar content and similar textbooks and so on, I think that would be an advantage, frankly. But,
yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for your quick adaptability, Bob, since we didn't tell you you were coming up for that question.
Very welcome. Thank you.
We have a number of other people who have signed up to testify, and I'm just counting we have four, so let's do two and two. Ashley Jackson and Joaquin Ramos, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos. My name is Joaquin Ramos, and I'm here with the Oregon Student Association in support of HB 2516 with the -4 amendments. I am currently a sophomore at the University of Oregon, and as I said, I'm a member of the Oregon Student Association. And I'm currently studying ethnic studies and French. Those are my two majors. And I plan on going to law school and becoming a district attorney and fighting for the racial disparities within the legal system through that power. But what I'm here to talk to you about is the textbook affordability. And I would like to talk about my personal experiences and how I have had to face the struggle of either choosing textbooks over food. So I generously got a scholarship to the University of Oregon, and I don't have to pay for tuition. That's completely covered, and I get a refund check every year or every term. And that's supposed to cover food, expenses, rent, as well as textbooks. But what I've noticed is that textbook prices keep increasing, but I don't get more and more money. So I have to cover more of that money goes to textbooks than it's had in the past year. So I have to keep on making the choice, like, do I want to spend this money on food or do I have to want to buy my textbooks this year? What I've had to do is, like, stop buying some of my textbooks for some of my classes and choose to eat, which is a reasonable decision. And then I also rely on food banks. Last year I had to rely on a food bank several times so that I could get food. And the reason that, like, this is important is because, like, textbooks keep increasing and we keep having to pay so much money for textbooks when, and tuition keeps increasing and everything keeps increasing, but the money, like, coming in doesn't. So I feel like a textbook affordability plan would really help students, and it would help students have to, like, worry about one less thing. And I hear a lot about, like, oh, you can share textbooks or you can rent them out from the library, but sometimes the library doesn't have the textbooks that you need. Sometimes the library doesn't have, or sometimes you're fighting against five other students to get the textbook that is needed for the same class, because in a class of 500 students, not everyone affords a textbook and they have one copy in the library. So it would be, it's difficult to get a hold of these materials if you don't, if you cannot afford them. So thank you for having me testify, and I'm totally in support of HB 2516 with the -4 amendments.
Sure. Ms. Jackson.
Good morning, Representative Reed. Thank you, committee members, for having us here. I'm here to give my personal story in regards to affordability and the price.
And I'm sorry to interrupt. You could introduce yourself for our record. We'd appreciate that, too.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. My name is Ashley Jackson. I'm in my second year at Lane Community College. I'm also the vice president of the Associated Students of Lane Community College. My personal, so I'm here because I very much am asking for your support on House Bill 2516, or the amendment to. And my personal story with this issue is that I have two children. I'm a single mom. And I think that every single term, the prices of textbooks becomes an issue, like Joaquin said, of do I put food in the house, or do I keep my cell phone on, or do I buy this textbook? And of course, I'm going to keep my cell phone on. Of course, I'm going to feed my family before buying a textbook that I don't even use all of in my class. The prices, like Joaquin said, are going up, and we're not getting more funding. The impact of the prices of textbooks on students most of the time is that we will not enroll in a class that requires a very expensive textbook, and that prolongs our graduation, sometimes even by a year, because some classes are only offered once a year. And it seems like the classes that are required for our degrees have the most expensive textbooks. So I also want to bring to light that Lane Community College has one of the highest houseless, homeless populations of students, and that my story, whereas it affects me and my children, yes, this is a recurrent theme across our entire campus. In fall term, the student government at Lane Community College surveyed 788 students, and 68% of the students answered the question, are the prices of textbooks a factor in you taking and enrolling in a class? And 68% of students said yes. That is a huge factor for them to enroll in classes. And, I think when we're considering a trade-off, like, do I pay for after-school childcare? Do I feed my family? Do I enroll in, over textbooks? That's not a trade-off that students should have to be making. We also found in our survey that students at Lane Community College are spending $200 to $400 each term on textbooks, and that's something that's after tuition. That's coming out of the portion of our financial aid and loan packages that's supposed to be paying our rent. It's just a disparity to have to choose whether we have a roof over our head or the book that gets, helps us be successful in school. As I've been working on open educational resources, I naturally came into contact with OSU. And the students over there and the administration over there are working very hard on implementing OERs. We already have 40 classes at Lane Community College that offer all free and online resources, and they are available also in a printed format for very low cost. Students flood those classes. They are always full before, you know, before registration even closes. So OERs are the future. That is the future that we're looking at. We already use OERs on a daily basis. And the next step is, for this viable solution, is state funding. And so that's why I'm here to just tell you my personal story with textbooks and the outrageous cost of textbooks and the promising solution of open educational resources. So thank you very much for...
Thank you for your testimony. Representative McEwen.
Chair Reed, thank you so much for being here and taking your time to enlighten us. We do know that this is a significant problem. I'm looking at the student budgets that were published by OSAC for the 14-15 school year, and it's really intriguing to me if you look at the cost of books and supplies across the Oregon our university system, and our community college system. The average cost of books and supplies for the community colleges is on average significantly higher than our university schools, university system schools. They're ranging from $1,986 a year. I believe the lowest is about $1,200, and at the university level, they range from $900 up to the highest, which is $2,000. The affordability for community college students is just a tremendous burden as it is at the university level. And I just wanted to draw attention to that. And I'm really interested to see, now that you're mentioning that you have 40 courses available as an OER, Mr. Brew said this is a year old. They take last year's and they get they get the number from the school and they publish it, and it's used to the calculation. How that's going to beginning to drop if students are flocking to those already. And I think as we move through this process, I want to assure that the heck through this conversation, make sure that the community college is a robust part of this implementation in this conversation. But thank you so much for your testimony, and thank you for your good work in student government and with the Oregon Student Association. You're the ones that make all the difference when you come and talk. So we appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want a couple of things. One, I have to tell you, I am always in awe of single parents who are going to school. I mean, I can't imagine how much work that is. I mean, thank you. I also can share with you, my daughter's a second-year student at Mount Hood Community College, and I have to help her with her books, too. And then she has to have two jobs just to get through with all the tuition and stuff. And Joaquin, I appreciate your testimony as well. I mean, one of the things I think that we have to remember, too, is we're thinking about the demographic of first-generation low-income students. How do we, you know, reach that demographic as part of our 40-40-20 aspirational goals? So, again, you know, this is one way we can help that group get through. But one thing, you know, you mentioned the library. I always had trouble with the libraries, and I hope nobody's watching from my university. But, you know, what I would try to do, I'd try to order at least a couple of my textbooks and put them into the library. But I always had to do that in secret from the bookstore, because the bookstore sure didn't want me to do that, right? So, but as you say, you know, it's really difficult to rely on the libraries to have those textbooks. So thank you again for that.
Thank you. Hopefully you haven't put any emeritus status at risk or anything.
I just want to bring to light that the most expensive textbook on our campus right now, as I know, is our second language textbooks. They're almost $500 for the required classroom materials. These are core classes to transfer to a university. You have to have two terms of second language to transfer. In my opinion, that focus, as well as math and the sciences with labs, those courses would be the first ones to get attention as far as a real dedication to switching to OERs. Because OERs really stem out of a second language acquisition platform historically, and then two, because they are the most expensive and the most consistent class that students have to take. So just to insert that as a little tidbit, it's definitely expensive. So.
That's helpful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. Next on our list, Christian Mello and Felicia Dickinson, I think. I got those right.
There should be a correlation between the...
that's a required class that they have to have.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Gotcha. My name is Felicia Dickinson, and I am a second-year undergraduate student at Lane Community College, as well as a senator with our student government. I'm here today to speak about Bill HB2516-4 amendments and how your support would mean, well, how much your support would mean to the student body. As a student leader, I see students struggle every day with the choice of paying for food or paying for a textbook. It's a sad state of affairs that students have to pay so much for the right to better themselves and their future. Students I have talked to often let the cost of a textbook affect the outcome of the classes they choose. When I first began college, I was lucky enough to have my parents pay for school in Illinois. So the cost of textbooks didn't really affect me at first. Then I moved to Oregon and started Lane. I no longer had my parents' financial support, and I was on my own. There have been a few classes I couldn't take because a textbook cost over $200. Students need to be able to spend their energy focusing on school, not how to stay afloat. The Open Educational Resource Movement is not only about affordability, it is also about advancing education in this technology-driven age. There are so many ways people learn, visually, auditory, and direct hands-on experience. Using OERs in the classroom would allow students to take their education in their own hands. If they have a tricky math problem, they can watch a video showing them how to do it step by step. Don't have time to read 10 chapters because you work an 8-hour shift in your part-time job? If audiobooks were available for classes, that would be a flexible option for those working students. Students attending our community college are the future of this state. So we ask the state of Oregon to invest in our future and help us succeed by funding open educational resources. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Ms. Dickinson. Sir?
Chair Reed, Vice Chairs Wisnett and Gallegos. For the record, my name is Christian Mello, and I am a student of Lane Community College, as well as a member of the Oregon Student Association. I should also mention, for the record, that I'm a dual enrollee of Oregon State University, so as it turns out, this bill and its amendment have a little more relevance to me now. I'm an undergraduate, and I'm a STEM major. I'm majoring in computer science, and I'll be getting my associate's degree pretty soon and transferring to Oregon State University. And I'm here to represent all of those who haven't gotten as far as me due to the prohibitive cost of class materials, and especially textbooks. And I'll be telling my personal story for my urge in support of House Bill 2516 and its -4 amendment. When I was living with my family, not worrying about my financial situation or just paying for things on my own, I was pretty unaware in general of the true price of college. After getting out of the house and losing my financial aid for a while, I was forced to pay for college on my own and realized pretty quick that there'd have to be sacrifices if I wanted to pass even the simplest of classes. One thing that schools don't consider is the drastic cost that comes on top of tuition. And I mean, while I was taking a physics course just last term, my tuition was a total of $490 for the course at $98 a credit, which is pretty cheap, and this is basically the reason I'm going to a community college first. But what I didn't realize until after I registered for the course was the cost of the materials. The entirety of the required book pack for my course at my college bookstore was $400, which made up over 80% of the cost of the tuition for the course. And to add on to this, a few of the books in the pack weren't even used in the course for that term. And given that the book was in a sealed plastic pack of a few books, none of the books were returnable if I had bought it and opened the pack. This was at my college bookstore, and it took me scouring the internet on my own to even find a remotely better deal. And that was with luck. Had I known about this implicit cost prior to registration and class selection, I might have been able to plan a little differently. I find this kind of practice kind of unforgivable, and the only way we can stop this is with the support of bills like 2516 and the proposed amendment. Without the help of proposed alternatives like the Open Oregon State Program and open educational resources in general, we're continuously losing students who might not be as shopping savvy as I am for high textbook costs when their money could be better spent on places to live or food. Many students, and this is kind of a terrible thing, find themselves even pirating electronic copies of textbooks rather than spending money on it to ensure they have a chance of staying out of debt. And that right there crime for survival's sake. I think that's a pretty emblematic of where college students are nowadays. And for these reasons, again, I urge you to support House Bill 2516 and its proposed amendment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for the U.S. Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, just thank you for your testimony. Really appreciate that, and one from a personal experience for me, and that I'm think is included in this conversation, but it may not be included in the conversation. After graduating from college, going on to graduate school, I come from a family that concentrated on public health. And so we didn't have the funds, or my folks didn't have the funds to send me, so I relied entirely on, you know, what I could work and what grants I could get. And fortunately, I had some fairly wealthy friends that were able to buy the textbook, but I couldn't even afford to copy them, right? Mm-hmm. So I developed something where I would borrow it, you know, for the night and read the first sentence of every paragraph, and it actually works pretty well. You get about 90% of the information.
Wow.
And get through it as quickly as I could. But I'd encourage the conversation to also include graduate and residency programs, because there are people in those situations like I was that were able to, through grants and Pell Grants and what was available, to get that education regardless of my family being able to contribute to it, but still struggle even once you get to that level of education. So I think it's important to include that conversation also.
Good point. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. That completes the list of people who have testified or who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2516 and 2513. Is there anyone else who wants to testify?
Sure, I have a question.
Yes, Representative Reardon.
Couldn't ask students, but are the bookstores a profit center for the schools?
I don't know the answer to that.
It'd be a really good thing to understand.
What was the question is whether the bookstores are profit centers for the universities. Come on up, please.
Thank you.
If you could reintroduce yourself, please.
My name is Ashley Jackson. I'm a student at Lane Community Thanks. College. In meetings with our bookstore director, they, to keep prices low, are not profiting. Their profit margin on textbooks is so low that sweatpants are beating the textbooks and profit margins. We do rely on the revenue from the textbook store, from our bookstore, going into our college to keep the fiscal health, you know, to keep everything where it's at. I just wanted to interject that we aren't profiting on textbooks at all. We literally are profiting more on a pair of sweatpants that say Lane Titans on it than we are that $500 Spanish textbook.
Yeah. So. Thanks. That's a good point. The different product lines and it can have very different different margins. Thank you. So we'll get back to that. So I think it's clear there's work to be done here. I appreciate Representative Wisdom, Representative Johnson's suggestion about a work group. I think that makes sense. So stay tuned. I'll be in touch, and we'll figure out how we go forward. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2516 and 2513. And I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Wisdom. And we'll move on to
So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2513.
2747. You should have given it to me.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2747 increases the limitation on subtraction for contributions to college savings network accounts to amount per designated beneficiary, prohibits reduction of state share of Oregon Opportunity Grant based on amounts available from college savings network account, establishes refundable credit against personal income taxes for contributions to college savings network account, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2015, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die, and does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Thank you, Mrs. Cox. Again, we're at this public hearing on House Bill 2747. Representative Reed, Chair Reed, you want to introduce your bill and
yes, please.
Explain,
Thank you, Mr.
explain
Chair.
It to us. It's a lot of financials here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. House Bill 2747 is about 529 college savings plans, and after I make a few comments, we're going to hear from the executive director of the 529 Network, Mr. Parker. I think everyone here recognizes the great cost of higher education. At the same time, the great promise of higher education. We've heard great testimony today and throughout our time together about both of those things. The 529 networks are not the only solution to that challenge, but they are an important element of how people can figure out how to pay for higher education. We've recognized that, I think, as a state through our tax policies. We have a tax deduction for contributions to the 529 network, and even a few years ago, we passed a bill, important to note this as we approach the tax deadline, to make it possible for people to directly deposit state tax refunds into 529 plans. So if you're in that situation, or if you know other people, remember that that's possible as you're filling out your taxes this year. So this bill does three things to, I think, make the 529 option even more effective and reach even more people. So describe those very briefly and then come back and join you. The tax deduction that exists now is on a per taxpayer basis. Mm-hmm. This bill would change, as written, would change that to per beneficiary. So if a family has multiple children, they could take advantage of that deduction for each of their children. The second thing it does is to recognize that the deduction is only useful if you have sufficient income against which to deduct your contribution. It is not useful if you don't. So this bill adds a refundable tax credit at the low end of the income distribution. So that's to make that same incentive, or a similar one at least, available to people who don't have sufficient income for the deduction to be useful. And finally, we want to make sure that there is no penalty for savings. And what I mean by that is, imagine a family who does a good job of saving, accumulates some resources in a 529 plan, and then gets to the place where they're ready to head off to school, or the student is. They still need some help. They apply for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but part of what the Oregon Opportunity Grant might do is consider what assets are available to the family. We want to make sure that those assets that they have diligently accumulated in the 529 network are not included in that, so that there is not a penalty for savings. Those are the three elements of the bill. There are, of course, costs to these things, and we may need to consider how we scale the bill before I hope we are able to send it to the Revenue Committee and continue its progress. But that's the outline. I think it's an important thing for us to do what we can to make it easier for people to take control of their own situations and to prepare for college by saving for it. So I'm happy to get out to answer your questions, happy to get out of the way and let the experts speak as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Would you like to have questions now first for you?
I think I should probably have any questions you have for me, and then I'll get out of the way.
Any questions of the committee? Representative Reed, go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question regarding this bill and the new ABLE accounts that have been enacted by Congress, I think as of March 3rd of this year. It is a modeled after the 529 plans for parents with children with disabilities to allow them to save for the lifetime. A child with disabilities that is going to take lifetime care costs about $5 million for the life of that child. Like a Down syndrome or something. And so the ABLE accounts are intended to help parents save for that, but not like the 529 plans that is for college, but to extend that savings for the lifetime child of that care. Yep. Would there be an opportunity to include that in this conversation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I don't have any problem including it in the conversation. I am not nearly as familiar with the ABLE program as I am with 529. I know Mr. Parker can answer that better than I can. I would say I think all of these questions are going to be impacted by our budget situation and what we can and can't afford, but I have no objection to having the conversation. Mr. Parker, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. The ABLE Act was passed by Congress back in December. There is a bill, Senate Bill 777, that allows the state of Oregon to hook into that federal code, 529A. That bill calls for the state to hook into the code and direct the Oregon College Savings Network to begin to administer the ABLE Act. And you're right, they are different but similar. While it's 529A, the ABLE Act allows for a lot more than college. You're talking about expenses for transportation and housing and medical expenses. So it's going to span that child's lifetime well into adulthood as well, depending on how many assets that they accumulate. So the answer is yes, that we believe that if 777 passes, we're going to be able to integrate these programs together and run them as a joint program.
Great. I wasn't aware of that bill, but would be a big supporter of it.
Thank you.
Other questions for Representative Reed? Okay. If you'll return to the Ms. Large, you want to go ahead and start with Mr. Parker? Okay, Mr. Parker.
So again, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. And Representative Reed did a fantastic job of introducing 2747. So what I thought I'd do is just give the committee just a quick overview on the 529 network, since you may or may not know some of the things that we do. The Oregon State Legislature passed the law in 1999 connecting to Section 529 of the Internal Revenue Code, creating the Oregon College Savings Network. So we've been in business for a little over almost 15 years now. The network was created to basically educate Oregonians about higher education planning, increasing their ability to save for that higher education, and then lastly, really reduce their reliance as much as possible on having to go into any major debt to fund a higher education. It is a unique investment tool that provides not only low-cost mutual funds and investments, but it also provides the flexibility for families to use it throughout a child's life or throughout a family's lifetime. Oregon currently operates two 529 plans, the Oregon College Savings Plan, which is the plan sold directly to consumers, directly to investors. It is our flagship program. We also offer a program through a company called MFS, which is a plan sold exclusively through financial advisors. The reason it's split like that is some folks want to buy it directly, and some folks want to use a financial advisor, so we have an option for both of those groups to use those. Each plan offers unique features and a variety of choices and contribution options. So while the plans are they're governed by the 529, they're governed by the state law, they operate independently of each other. Both plans are administered by the Oregon 529 College Savings Board. That board is staffed by the state treasurer. I work for the state treasurer over here in Salem. And just briefly, the network has grown tremendously in 15 years. It's hard to believe that I've been here that long, actually, starting out with no dollars in our plan. The network now manages $2.3 billion in college savings assets and servicing about 154,000 accounts. And we have accounts in every single Oregon county, which is a nice thing for us to say. But as much as it is nice to hear those numbers, it's also very important to understand that investors using the program for its intended purpose. So we really want them to invest and then use the dollars. And this is a number I'm very proud of. Over the past 4 years, we've distributed nearly $300 million for folks, for families to go to college. So we're now a mature program, so we're really seeing the distributions now being taken, and it's nice to see families are using those assets to send their kids to school. That's a number I'm very proud of. Just some additional benefits, as Chair Reed had mentioned about the 529 plan. There is an annual Oregon State income tax deduction on these programs. All the assets in these plans grow state and federally tax-free, which is a nice benefit. And the funds can be used nationwide for a variety of expenses. We've heard a lot about books. You can use these for books, tuition, room, board, and other expenses.
Can I interrupt you just for a second? As we're being joined, it looks like, by the Corbett Cardinals. So I thought we should maybe just give a little context to where you are so they get a sense of what we're talking about. We're hearing a bill on the 529 College Savings Plan, which hopefully you're all planning for your post-high school experiences. This is Michael Parker, who's the director of the 529 Network. He's describing how it started and how it works and what this bill might be about. So we're glad you're here. Sorry for interrupting.
No problem, Chair. Again, you can use 529 assets for pretty much any required cost for college, including tuition, books, room and board, and other required fees. But as great as all these benefits are, I think we need to realize, as Chair Reed had mentioned, that we can do more. Providing additional incentives to encourage more saving will help students and their families avoid mountains of college debt. And, you know, just briefly, debt's becoming a real serious problem, as many of us have heard. Many students will attest to the debt. I had debt when I was going to school. It's becoming quite a burden. And according to the Wall Street Journal, a greater share of students are now turning to debt, unfortunately. It was 20 years ago, about 50% of students were turning to debt. Now it's up to 70% of students are turning to debt to fund a college education. Unfortunately, the class of 2014 is going to be the most indebted class ever, with an average debt load of about $33,000. Again, this is not news. This is what most folks have heard. And the current outstanding debt, college debt in the nation, tops about $1.2 trillion. So it's becoming an issue, and this is where savings plans like the Oregon College Savings Plan, or any other 529 plan for that matter in the nation, are going to help families avoid that debt load, give students as they graduate more opportunities to do what they want instead of having to service that debt load. So that's where 2747 really comes into play. The more incentives that we can offer to families, the more we can get them to save for college rather than going into debt or even not going to school, is going to benefit this state in the long run. So I won't go into, again, 2747, since Representative Reed did a great job of that, but just here to tell you that we see a lot of families go through our plan, and we hear a lot of evidence of how they use it, why they use it. Clearly, the real key benefit to a 529 plan is the tax benefits. You can save your money anywhere you want, but if the state's giving you tax benefits, the federal government's giving you tax benefits, you're more apt to save. So I will leave you with the more incentives we can give families and students, the more they're apt to save, then less debt they're going to accumulate through that lifetime and over that 4 or 5 years they're going to school. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions or move on to Mr. Large.
Let's hear from Dr. Large. And I neglected, as I was waving you up, to invite Mr. Brew up too. He's also got some comments, so perhaps he can join you in that other seat while you get started, Dr. Large.
Yes. My name is Larry Large. I am the president of the Alliance of Private Colleges and Universities in the state of Oregon. But I come to you today with three different perspectives. One of those is what I just announced. I think this one works.
One's fine, yep.
The second one is, in the spirit of full disclosure, I am also a member of the 529 board through the treasurer's office, and want to make sure everybody understands that. And the third perspective is just as a longtime educator and what the kind of impact that a bill like this can have. I think you're all familiar with the demographics of the state and how we have to, in order to achieve the 40-40-20 goals or even come close to those, we're going to have to make sure we are serving the lower income students. And a 529 program like this, where the tax incentives include the refund that Representative Reed has explicated for all of you, is a very important point. And I say that based on some actual research that we have done in the Alliance. Now, it's not specific to the 529 program, but we're active with a program where we've raised over $1 million for students in this very low-income category called the Matched College Savings Program. You heard some of that testimony last Friday from some of your witnesses on the tax credit legislation. We hired Echo Northwest to survey our students in our institutions who are below that poverty level and who are active in the savings for their own education. And their performance to completion far exceeds what the performance is of others in that low-income bracket and matches or exceeds what it is that the normal cohort of students do in the upper income. And you know that delta exists between the upper-income students who complete college versus those who are lower income students who don't. Providing this extraordinary incentive is a very important variable, and we've actually verified that with some research probably on the order of magnitude of about 300 students, so that it's a clear and important point. That's it. We're in support of all three of my perspectives of House Bill 2747. We think it's a critical step in helping the state of Oregon and those lower-income students meet their needs as well as the long-term needs of the state.
Thank you very much.
Happy to take questions.
Thanks. Let's hear from Mr. Brew and then take questions.
Thanks. Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Bob Brew, and I am the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, more commonly known as OSAC. We are the Student Financial Aid and Access arm of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and we administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant, among many other grants and scholarships. I'm here today specifically to discuss Section 2 of House Bill 2747. At the end of Section 2, proposed new language would prohibit OSAC from reducing, quote, the amount of the state share based on amounts available to a student by virtue of being designated beneficiary of a college savings network account, end quote. As we understand it, Section 2 of the proposed bill would have no direct effect on the Oregon Opportunity Grant or on the formula currently used to determine award eligibility. For several years, the state share has been equal to a fixed maximum opportunity grant award amount. Only students whose remaining financial need meets or exceeds the maximum opportunity grant award amount are currently eligible to receive a grant. Those whose financial need is less than the maximum amount are not awarded. The state share is equal to the maximum annual award amount. And since no adjustments are made to the state share at the end of the calculation, the proposed bill would not affect how award amounts are calculated now and would simply prohibit certain options for future reductions. We do not believe that the proposed bill would have any effect on how opportunity grant awards are calculated. In short, we already comply with the provisions that would prohibit us from subtracting a 529 account from the state share of the opportunity grant calculation. Short but sweet.
Thank you.
I'll be glad to answer any questions.
I just want to make sure I understand that, and then I know Representative Gallegos has a question. Essentially, I hear you saying that that doesn't change how the bill would not change how you do things currently, mm-hmm. but would ensure that someone in the future would not be able to reduce the amount based on 529 assets. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Large, thank you for all your hats and all your work. I had a question with regard. Well, first, I'd like to see if we could get a copy of that Eco Northwest report, that study
yes.
you mentioned.
Be happy to provide that.
And the thing I'm really curious about is how do we promote the program, particularly to low income first generation communities?
Representative Gallegos, Chair Reed, and members of the committee, the 529 staff does the heavy lifting, if you will, around the state with a very organized set of programs. With the Match College Savings Plan, we actually do that within the alliance. Now, these are parallel, compatible programs, and principally addressing a lot of the lower income, clearly addressing lower income parts of our population. But we have, just last Saturday, we had a day-long thing at Western Oregon University, where along with our partners in the public university system, as well as the private colleges, had a Cesar Chavez Day, where we targeted the lower income students, bring them in, talk about it. We have a requirement in that program that says that there has to be a certain number of classroom hours spent on financial literacy so that they know what their costs are, how this works. And in the Match College Savings Program, they must save a certain amount of money, which we are then able to match with gift money and other sources, including some federal dollars, that equals up to five times what the students are able to save. But this engagement, Representative, I think is the critical, and I can't scientifically prove this, mm-hmm. but when the students have, if you will, skin in the game, there's greater commitment on their part, and anything we can do to incentivize their engagement and make them contributing partners to their own financial right. package, the better students they're yeah. going to be and the more likely they are to graduate, and that's what our study shows.
Another part of the answer to your question, and maybe follow too, the last, I forget exactly when, but Mr. Parker will remind us, the Ways and Means Committee approved I think the first time in 10 years or something, an additional person in the office. So they're now up to, I think, 2.5 mm-hmm. people doing specific outreach. So please feel free to add to that too.
Just a follow-up. I mean, I would say that there is research data that supports the notion. I think it's a Coleman report from way back, but basically the notion, one of the findings was that it wasn't just resources that was an indicator of success in education, but family values. Mm-hmm. Family values. And so if we can help some of these communities to recognize the value of saving of education, I think that does really contribute then to the success of the student as they go along. But yeah, thank you. I mean, I was thinking about people like at Hood River or in Cornelius, mm-hmm. Folks there who maybe Spanish is their first language or English may not be their first language, how we really need to sort of adjust and adapt to those communities. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Parker, I should know the answer to this, but are there both federal and state tax benefits with a 529 plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there are federal benefits and state benefits. The federal benefits are the tax-free growth. So you're putting money in, whatever you're earning is not being taxed, state or federally, and then the state benefit is that state tax deduction.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up? Yes, please.
Do we have any idea how many families might benefit from changing the criteria here from per taxpayer to actually kind of per kid? You could get the benefit here. Do you have any idea how many families out there might be benefited in a positive way?
Representative Johnson, we did some research and actually looked at some things, and I think the average family that we're serving right now has like 1.8 children.
Oh.
So I think we would definitely see a benefit of that. The other piece to that is we do a lot of work with grandparents, and so they want to give grandkids some dollars, and so that would help spread that money out as well for the grandparents to give the grandkids the dollars, as Mr. Large does in his accounts. But, Mr. Reed, if I may, just to follow up on the comment, we do a lot of outreach to a lot of communities. We have two comments on that. Yeah. One thing that we're doing now, again, we have a new outreach director, which we haven't had since the plan began, and we're directing that outreach director to work directly with every single community in the state and mostly with parent groups around the state to make sure that we get the message out to these groups. So that is something that we're definitely focused on. We also do a lot of presentations to a lot of minority communities in the state, specifically Spanish-speaking individuals, where we'll have a translator come in. All of our materials in Spanish as well, trying to make sure that they understand what it will take to get their kids in and through school.
Mr. Parker and his colleague, Mr. Valley, do a great town hall, too. So any legislators who are interested in that, Representative Johnson.
One follow-up then, too. Mr. Parker, I'm sure you're aware of what the president proposed in his State of the Union this year, i.e. Changing the rules, if you will, on these plans. How has that, let's say, impacted what you do, or has it created any uncertainty in the long-term financial benefits of what you guys are trying to accomplish?
Chair, Representative Johnson, I didn't get much sleep that one night when that happened. However, we got a couple of phone calls. I will acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. I work with a lot of folks around the country that are in my position, and the same thing. They got a lot of phone calls about what this means. The good thing is it turned very quickly. So the president did recant and take that off the table. I think if that would have lingered, I think certainly we would have had some uncertainty. I don't think it would have necessarily meant people aren't going to invest, but there definitely would have been this, wait a minute, what's going to happen 5 years from now when this thing goes into effect? So it would have had an impact. And I think the great thing about this, and you make lemonade here, is the president kind of did us a favor. He really highlighted how these plans can really help you. And the fact is that these plans really are helping middle-income families around the country. Mm-hmm. A research recently showed that 57% of the folks that are using a 529 plan have a household income of $100,000 and under. So really is not, the very wealthy putting money in these plans. It's middle-income folks that are using these because they know they can't foot the bill all at once when the time comes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rudin?
Just thinking of I toured one of the early childhood centers, and they all had, the year the kid was going to graduate. And also
from
thinking—
high school, right? From high school?
From college.
Oh, okay, great.
From college, yeah. And also thinking about the power of compound interest. And do we aggressively target, at birth or maybe the early childhood, kindergarten, that level?
Chair Reed, Representative Reardon, yes, we are really actively right now, in fact, it's a great question, trying to really drive our average age and of our beneficiaries down. Right now, our average age is about 10 and a half. We would like to see that about half of that. So we have a couple of hospital programs that we're working on. In fact, we're working with Senator Steiner Hayward to try to get some more information into the hospital, into the birthing centers, to make sure that parents know when they leave, here's an option that they can do. Again, working with those PTA groups all the way down to preschool and kindergarten, so the parents know this is an option. We've seen some research that shows that new parents, necessarily parents that just had babies, they're, you know, they've got a lot on their mind. They're not necessarily worried about college students at that point. But once that child gets about preschool age, that's when that really what kicks in. They're going to school now. How's that going to play out in 15, 18, 20 years? So we are definitely working on trying to drive that age down.
There have also been some great programs around the country, some states and some localities who have started either matching or starting accounts for babies or very young kids with a sort of an initial contribution that's conditioned on regular contributions for the family.
I think even if you put $100 in, it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one study I remember seeing that suggests that a kid who has an account is four times as likely to graduate from college, regardless of the amount that's in the account, just the fact that it exists and they have an expectation.
Let's do that.
Yeah, indeed. Representative Hayden.
Chair, this may be a premature question, but I noticed that it establishes a refundable credit against personal income tax or for contributions to College Saving Network. How will that impact the state? I mean, can you lay out a scenario? Most of the people that are able to afford to contribute to this would generally have a taxable income. So just trying to get that clear in my head.
Sure. Well, I could start with the answer, and I'd be glad to have you guys add up. I think that's just the difference, the deduction versus the credits. The deduction, you're right, is available to people who have income and can, you know, but it's only available to those. It's only useful to those sorts of folks. So the idea of adding the credit is to make that same advantage available to people who don't have sufficient income to make use of the deduction. So this is part of what I was trying to lightly touch on at the end of my testimony, that I think these are all good things, but in our current budget environment, we may well have to scale this to something we think is affordable before we send it on to the Revenue Committee. So we're engaged in ongoing conversation with the Legislative Revenue Office, who does the revenue impacts, to figure out if we change this, to this level, what's the resulting revenue impact statement. So I'm not sure what we'll come up with, but those are all moving parts.
Thank you.
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, I think, you know, just personally speaking, we really want to make sure that we're hitting every single demographic target in the state and every region of the state. The deduction is great. As Chair Reed had mentioned, it works great. It's an incentive. But if you don't have sufficient income to really make it matter, it doesn't help you. The credit is a direct money back into your pocket to get you to save. So the point, again, Chair Reed made about just having the account, even if you're not putting a ton of money in it, the kid knows it's there. Parents can talk about it with the child. That they can change the culture of that kid going to school. So having them be able to get the $500 and have it right back, so the account is open, and then, you know, family and friends can contribute as well. So having the account is really that target, which is what that $500 credit I think really would do for us.
Go ahead, Representative, please. Oh, thank you, Chair. And so I say this quite often, I think, in human services, but is there an avenue to make that refundable credit apply monthly back to the parents that are really struggling to put $50 a month into their child's education but can't afford to wait until April 15 or whenever? And so some qualification criteria that would allow them to put $50 a month, but yet if we know historically last year that they used a refundable in their second year of that program to encourage that refund would come back to them monthly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's just a cash flow issue to allow lower income parents to be able to afford to do it, because they simply just can't wait 12 months for that.
Chair Representative Hayden, we would support any way to help folks do this. So if that's something that is possible, we certainly, it would not matter to us as far as the program goes, because we take in monthly contributions all the time. So any barriers we can break down, we're all for doing that.
So, Representative Wisdom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Parker, what interest rates 529 accounts earn now? And does that adjust? Do you go, or is it once you sign up, it's forever?
Sure. Representative Chair Reed, Representative Wisnett, the College Savings Plan currently has about 15 investment options in it, and they range from stock options all the way down to a principally protected option. So depending on the investor's risk tolerance for investments, our most popular option is called age-based, which is basically you invest based on the age of your child. Mm-hmm. So the younger your child is, the more aggressive we're going to put the money in the market. As that child ages automatically, we move that money down to more conservative investments. So we don't just have one investment return, similar to like PERS, kind of, which would show your return. We have different returns for each of our portfolios. But again, we built it in a way to try to get everybody that wants to invest an option that they would like to have. So again, you can be aggressive, you can be very conservative, really just depends on your current need and your risk tolerance.
Clarification.
Yep, please.
So that's good. So you're not tying it, I put my money in, now it's guaranteed 2% or 1% or whatever. You decide which investment strategy you want, aggressive, safe, whatever, and you're investing in that, just like the PERS programs and things like that, or the retirement programs. That's what you do.
Chair Representative Wizard, that is correct.
And finally, Mr. Chair, yep. So can you tell me overall what gain is it, 5%? 3%, 4%, what do you think?
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnett, again, it really depends on where you're at. We have a lot of options that basically will track a specific market. So, for example, we have options that would track the S&P 500. So folks can kind of see, well, this is where I want to put my money. I want to put it in domestic stocks. I want to put it in international stocks. But it really depends on what that market is doing at any point in time. I couldn't quote you a return because everything is different. Everything fluctuates every month. I can shoot you over our latest returns.
Thank you. I have my $30,000 PERS 401. I'm in small business caps. I think it's getting 5 or something like
sure.
that.
Sure.
Good. Any questions? I think we've covered it for today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. There's no one else who has signed up to testify on House Bill 2747. Is there anyone who would like to? Nobody from Corbett? Representative Johnson, these are your folks, right?
These are our folks. This is kids from Corbett, and they're teaching at Ferguson. They're here checking out their capital today, so please extend courtesies. They'll be around the building.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2747, and fortunately, we hit it just about right.
Yeah.
Time. Nice job, Victoria. Unless there's anything else to come before the committee, we'll adjourn. Thank you.
Hope it goes as well as.
Worked out.
Hope it goes as well as.
Yeah.